Filmed in Canada is a locale podcast about Canadian movies.
You can go to our website to view previous episodes and check out our written content at www.filmedincanada.net.
And you can email us with your thoughts at filmedincanada@gmail.com.
Or tweet at us. We are at filmedincanada, spelled by D-U-H at the end.
And I just recently created a Twitter account, filmed in Canada, I think D-O-H.
Really?
No. And you can also check out our Facebook group at Filmed in Canada Podcast.
I'm William.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Alexander.
And we are diving into one of the greatest movies in Canadian history.
Yes. The third greatest, in fact.
According to
the Toronto International Film Festival's top 10 best Canadian films, ooh, which actually consists of a list of 11. Because...
does something tie?
Because Stories We Tell and Sondi tied, yeah. Hmm. Or no, Stories We Tell and Les Autres tied. Oh. Sondi was left off the list.
Well, I would certainly like to rearrange that list. This to me was like The Red Violin. This is a movie that I'm trying very hard to find good things to say about it. So I'm very curious as to what you guys, your experiences of watching it for the first time, Alexander, and William watching it again 20 years in.
Did we actually say what the title of the movie
is? No.
Okay. It is The Sweet Hereafter, directed by Adam Egoyan. Mm-hmm. Up and Adam Egoyan. Up and at them.
From 1997.
Yes.
Yeah. So we are, yeah, like Chris said, that was more than 20 years ago. And a lot's been written and said about The Sweet Hereafter. So we may prove that enough has been said.
Winner of the Grand Prix at the Cannes Film Festival, mm-hmm, along with a couple other awards, I believe.
Sure. I picked up many Genies that year, and Adam McGuinn was nominated as Best Director at the Oscars that, mm-hmm, year.
It won the Independent Spirit Award for Best International Film.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So lots of accolades.
Mm-hmm.
If you've taken the Kool-Aid.
Right.
I guess might as well just warn people now that this can be full of spoilers, this talk, because it's an old enough movie, I think.
Right.
I think we'd expect people of anyone interested has seen it by now.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Interestingly, like the sort of main traumatic event in the movie doesn't really happen until about halfway through. Mm-hmm. It's kind of alluded to, I guess. But I guess there's some possibility that you could go into it not knowing that a bus full of kids dies.
That's possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It uses the same title as the book written by Russell Banks. So I guess if you were familiar with that source material, that'd be a clue as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Adam McGuinn, following his success with Exotica, he was attached to do a thriller for Warner Brothers. But he was growing increasingly frustrated that his Hollywood experience was an unending series of meetings. And his wife gave him Russell Banks' book. And he thought this was the kind of movie he wanted to make. But another studio had the options for The Sweet Hereafter. And then when he was talking with fellow Canadian author Margaret Atwood, he was lamenting how he wouldn't be able to get the rights to this because it was attached to another studio.
Hmm.
And she suggested he simply go to the author and ask directly. So he actually had a meeting with Russell Banks, who said that the options were expiring, and he was conflicted whether he would renew it with that studio because he didn't think that they were interested in making it. So Adam McGuinn convinced him to give him the next opportunity to make it, because he promised he would make a movie out of it.
Right.
And when his thriller for Warner Brothers was still stalled, he actually walked away from that deal so that he could make this The Sweet Hereafter, to fulfill his promise to Russell Banks.
Right. So we talked about Exotica probably like a couple of years ago at this point,
mm-hmm,
or at least a year ago.
Yes.
More than a year ago.
And I recall from that conversation that you, William, had somewhat of an about face with regards to that movie, given that on its initial release, you were not a fan of it, but it seemed that you warmed to it to a greater degree upon revisiting it.
I would hesitate to use the words warmed to than an Adam McGuire movie.
Right.
But I certainly, I think I appreciated Exotica more recently than I did on my initial viewing, yes.
Right. And would you say that you had a similar experience with this movie? Or did you
I liked it when
fall
I,
for The Sweet Hereafter when you saw it in the first...
I liked The Sweet Hereafter when I first saw it.
Yeah.
I certainly appreciated it. And I don't know if I like the movie, but I certainly appreciate it. I guess it seems like I feel the same way. I just think it's a really solid movie. I think the tone is... it's how it conveys sadness and mourning, I think, is very effective. I think it's just a good movie. It's not one that I would normally pop into the DVD player.
Right.
But I'd certainly appreciate it.
Okay. How about you, Chris?
It's like watching something through cheesecloth. Like, everything is so muted. I feel like there's no authentic emotions. There's no grieving. There's no mourning. There's no keening. Everyone just seems flatlined to me. And I realize that people can flatline and that's their manifestation of grief. But the whole town, like from the bus driver to the parents, the only people that show any emotion are the hippies, the autos.
Well, Bruce Greenwood's character does to an extent.
To an extent, but it's still pretty flat.
Yeah.
I don't want histrionics, but I do want an authentic reaction. Like, you realize how recent the deaths are when you visit Maury Chaykin and the character of Risa, who run the hotel. The flowers that they got for their child's funeral services are still behind them in the living room where they're entertaining the lawyer played by Ian Holm.
Right.
So you realize how recent the death is, and yet there's just no sort of demonstration of profound grief,
right?
Or just the decimation of losing your children. I don't see that played there. They have this ridiculous argument where he keeps telling her to shut up that we hear off camera while Ian Holm is on the phone with his daughter. And she's like, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. And it's just the most ridiculous argument I've ever heard. It, again, just does not seem authentic.
I thought that scene was interesting in how it introduces this idea that the people of this town are sort of, that they're hiding things and that they're trying to put on a good face for these lawyers and for the people that are coming through because they see the financial opportunity that's in front of them. And so maybe that, I feel like that is part of why you don't see the full extent of the grief that they're feeling, and that as soon as he steps away for a moment, they just devolve into pure anger. I don't know, I guess because you're not getting the real specifics of what that argument is, because you're focused on the foreground of Ian Holm talking to his daughter. It didn't bother me that it was just kind of this one note argument.
To me, it paralleled the daughter phoning her dad, and she kept saying the same, Daddy, why don't you? And she must have said daddy like 17 times. And I realized that she's a strung out junkie trying to manipulate her dad into giving her money. But again, it's the direction. It's not the acting. It goes on too long in a way that just completely pulls you out of the movie. It just goes on too long, too hysterical, too forced.
With the daughter, I would say that it is the acting.
Because Gabriel Rose is a great actress, but I think Egoyan directs her in a ridiculously Fargo-esque comic way that I don't think Dolores' character should have.
Right.
So I don't blame Gabriel Rose. I don't blame the actors. I think Egoyan.
No, I'm not talking misdirects. About. I'm talking about the daughter.
I'm not even willing to blame her.
Yeah.
Because there's so many other good people that I think Egoyan misdirects in this movie, that I'm not going to blame that that actress.
Right.
Though it seemed like a terrible performance.
Yeah.
But I'm not even going to blame her.
Okay.
I think Egoyan gets the performances that he wants to get. I think all of his movies, his actors are robots.
Yeah.
So,
how do you connect with that?
I don't think you're supposed to connect with it. I don't think Egoyan's movies invite you to see his characters as humans. I think he sees them as
chess pieces.
Yeah, something like that. They're symbols for something. They're symbols for a certain person or a certain type of experience. Mm-hmm. But they're not. They don't act and react the way that normal human people do.
Do you think that Ian Holm had more humanity as Ash in Alien than he does as this lawyer? And he's the most human character in this film.
I think Ian Holm is great in this movie.
Yeah, to the point of the sort of the humanity of the characters in question, and like you're saying, William, that they're meant to serve a purpose. They're not necessarily meant to be human characters, so to speak. I feel like the whole movie, in a way, is just kind of this construction of, like, showing what happens when you try to pull the secret in, and you can't succeed at that. And so the kids dying are just that's it's almost like the supernatural evil in a horror movie. Like, the kids dying are the reason that all of this stuff kind of comes out and Sarah Pauli does what she does at the end of the movie. And, like, just the fact that the whole thing is just this kind of weird retelling of the Pied Piper, like, all of that feels to me like it's more about creating this cohesive message that he wants to deliver as opposed to really trying to feel what these people are feeling.
I think when Adam Egoyan writes a script, I think he is observing his characters like they are an ant, like they're an ant farm or something. I think it's an experiment. He's putting these pieces into some sort of an aquarium, and he's just seeing how they react to one another. And maybe it's not, those reactions may not be what we can empathize with, but in his world, I think he's just examining, I think, how extreme stresses play on these types of characters. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Does that make sense? That's what I'm saying. I never...
It's just this sort of artificial construct, and mm-hmm. it is a chessboard, and okay. He's just moving people around. My problem is that it will always feel muted and flat and inauthentic because I'm not seeing real humans. I'm not interested in watching Westworld. You know what I mean? The Westworld of this small town, Sam Bent in BC, where this accident happens. I want to see real people having real emotions. I understand they're actors. But there's no point having this muted flatness. How is that interesting?
But I think ultimately, I find, in this particular instance, I find that to be an interesting contrast to another version of this movie that has that more human feel to it, because I think a big part of that message that he's trying to convey is just how detached these people have become and how disconnected from the world they are, and just how, like, that's kind of where our world is headed in a way. And I think the usage of the daughter calling Ian Holm on his cell phone is just kind of emblematic of that. And there's a really, like, fundamental quote from the movie that I think really speaks to what I'm talking to here. But there's a scene where Ian Holm is filming the inside of the bus, and he hears a car coming up. Bruce Greenwood gets out of his truck. Ian Holm is, like, hiding behind the sign, and then he comes back out and pretends like he's just walking upon him. And they have this exchange where Bruce Greenwood doesn't want to sign up with a lawyer. He just feels like he needs to grieve on his own, and he doesn't need any money out of it. That doesn't solve any problems for him. And Ian Holm throughout the movie, you get the sense that, or at least I got the sense that there's, you're kind of uncertain whether he's being genuine or not, and whether he really feels for these people or whether he's just in it for the money. In this exchange with Bruce Greenwood, his phone rings and he says, oh, that's probably my daughter, or it could be the police calling to tell me that she's dead. And he's like, why are you telling me this? And like, he kind of pauses when he gives that line about the police. And so you see it and immediately as this manipulation, because he's trying to relate with Bruce Greenwood. He's trying to say, you know, like, I lost my daughter too, not in the real sense of her being dead, but, you know, she's a drug addict. And so he then just kind of goes into this monologue mode where he's just kind of staring off into the distance and not connected with Bruce Greenwood anymore. And he says here, because we've lost all our children, they're dead to us. They're killing each other in the streets. They wander comatose through shopping malls. Something terrible has happened. It's taken our children away. It's too late. They're gone. And about halfway through this monologue, Bruce Greenwood just walks away and gets in his car. You're like, what the fuck is going on? Like this literally feels like an alien is like getting a message from his home planet. Right. Like, what the fuck is this? And so, and just the look on his face is completely dead and emotionless. I feel like that really is like what this movie is about. Mm-hmm. And specifically how that is manifested in the form of these parents just being completely detached. And Bruce Green was the only one, like, he's the one that's following them in the school bus every day. And so he's the one that's actually trying to connect with them. But these other ones are either abusing their children or just like don't know what the fuck's going on and are, you know, absorbed in their own issues and marital affairs and whatever. And yeah, so I guess that is kind of what the movie's about, I think.
I think you're onto something there. Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also in the closing voiceover, I think Sarah Pauling's character speaks it. Where she does allude to the title. She says she talks about it's the aftermath of this tragedy and I'm paraphrasing, we're all living in the suite you're after. Mm-hmm. I think she's referring to the town.
Yeah.
And the survivors. Mm-hmm. And it is this new reality for the survivors that they don't know how to behave anymore. That they're grieving in a strange way. They don't know if they're angry. They don't know if they can show love. So if we separate this from Adam McGuinn's other movies and we just look at it as its own thing, you know, Ian Holm character arrives in a town that is emotionally devastated and is living in some sort of limbo. And maybe you have to accept that they're not exhibiting the behavior that you would expect in normal society.
You can imagine the tragedy of, you know, the Humboldt bus crash and how an entire town was devastated by that. And again, I realize that people can be very repressed, and this geographical isolation of this town could mean also like an emotional isolation. Mm-hmm. But I don't even see grief except from the autos. Mm-hmm. So how has the town been devastated?
But Mitchell Stevens, the in-home character, mm-hmm. I mean, he's an agent that's arrived to help them through this, in a sense. He sees himself in this role. So he's said to them, because you don't know how to process this, let me be your anger. Mm-hmm. Right? He's saying you should react to what's happened with anger. So he's trying to pull them out of this stasis. So I think Chris, you're wanting these characters to act in a certain way, mm-hmm. that you've seen exhibited elsewhere.
Yes.
So you're not going to get
from that. Humans.
You're not going to get that. And I don't mind that this movie looks at grief in a different way. So I don't think that's a failing of the movie. I understand that it's a frustrating point. It's a frustrating characteristic of the movie. And I think I've always felt a little bit cold about Adam McGuinn's movies because of the way he uses his actors. But mm-hmm. I thought in this one it worked. let us now. This part is going to go into the near the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Much like the nonlinear nature of The Sweet Hereafter.
Yeah.
We are now going to talk about the plot.
Maybe I should just leave it here then. In that case. let's jump back a little bit. The Russell Banks's book, which came out in 1991, it was said to be inspired by an actual incident in Texas. A school bus accident happened. There was an accident with a school bus, and a small town was devastated at having lost so many children.
Yeah.
So Egoyan's movie, his screenplay takes that story and places it. It seems like it's in BC.
It's shot in Merritt.
Yeah.
It's intended to be set in BC.
It's intended. You think?
Yeah.
All right. And we're seeing the aftermath of this bus accident where a large number of the town's children have died. And Mitchell Stevens is a lawyer, played by Ian Holm, who is talking to a lot of the parents to convince them to take part in a class action lawsuit. The target is, maybe it's the bus company, maybe it's the highways,
or the school board or something like that.
So he's the guardrails, so it could be like Department of Transportation.
Yeah. So he's looking for some sort of a corporate target to direct the lawsuit against, so they can so the families can get a big payout. Mm-hmm. And then we meet a number of the parents. They all have secrets to some extent. And then one of the survivors is played by Sarah Polley.
I think the only survivor.
Other than the only one that we see on screen, but I think they, I don't think they say all the children died.
Yeah.
But Sarah Polley's the only character we see.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I don't know. And Dolores, the bus driver.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess, like I alluded to earlier, it is told in this nonlinear nature where you're getting bits and pieces of Ian Holm's relationship with his daughter, this exchange that he's having with a former friend of hers on an airplane. They just happen to be sitting next to each other, coincidentally. The incident itself, and then the before and after.
It's structured so that there's a lot of things that trigger flashbacks.
Yeah.
And I think I like what he does with that.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first few times it happened, I was a little bit... it took me a moment to catch up, to know that it was a flashback.
Right.
Yeah. But then the movie opens with actually a flashback as well. The opening image is... it's almost like a dream image, because Ian Holm's character is remembering this vacation they had, that he was sleeping on a mattress with his wife and their daughter was between them. So that also exists sort of just as a memory.
Yeah.
It's not, it's kind of out of time in terms of the events of the movies. So
especially because the space that they are existing in seems to be hundreds of feet long, because the opening title credits are swiping across the wood floor that they're on, but it goes on for quite a while.
Yeah. It's very dreamy.
Yeah.
And then it ends on a dream as well. So, I mean, the movie is bookended by dream images.
Dream image?
Yeah.
The ending?
Yeah. Well, in the end, we see... It could be a flashback or it could be a dream. But it's...
Sarah Polley.
Nicole, played by Sarah Polley. It goes back to her... putting her charges, she's babysitting and she's putting the kids back into bed, and then she's walking to the window, and then there's this blinding light, right?
So
it's a flashback or it's a dream.
Yeah. The car headlights of presumably Bruce Greenwood coming back. That's what I interpreted it to be.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Why Bruce Greenwood?
Because he got home before her father came to pick her up.
Okay.
So she would have seen him arrive.
Okay.
First. Mm-hmm. Speaking of that scene, and just like I alluded to with that other monologue that Ian Holm goes on of about how the children are lost. There's a few other instances in this movie where just like there's just these weird exchanges that seem like non sequiturs or just kind mm-hmm. of don't make a whole lot of sense. One of them being when Sarah Pauly's over babysitting the kids, she's like trying on these clothes, and then she comes down. So it turns out Bruce Greenwood's wife had died of cancer, and so she's taking some of the dead wife's clothes. And Bruce Greenwood says to her, you know, I think she probably would have given you that stuff herself if she hadn't outgrown it, or ... And it's like, what? She's an adult.
Yeah, and the only thing I could think of is...
isn't growing anymore.
Because she was pregnant when she got cancer and died, so she had outgrown right. those clothes. Like, I couldn't figure out what that line meant. All I could think of is she's chubbed out of them,
yeah.
or she's pregnant, or... like, it didn't seem to make sense. Or yeah. it was like, it's... now that you're a grown-up, you put away childish things. Like, yeah. is that, you know, she's too mature to be wearing those clothes. It should go to someone who's 13?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what the line meant.
And then, like, just that whole exchange in general is very strange. Because, like, I knew going into this movie that there was some form of child sexual abuse. But I didn't know in what form it would come about. And so... just the strangeness of that interaction, I was like, oh, I guess like Bruce Greenwood's the one that's abusing Sarah Pauly. Because he kind of reaches out to put his hand on her arm when she's leaving, but then he kind of doesn't. And then like, I think they might exchange a kiss, but I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Yeah. But anyway,
but it was awkward. I wasn't sure what was happening.
It was just a really awkward interaction. And so
I was like, oh God, he's not going to hit on her, is
he?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's like, is he also involved in this incident with the father or not, or I don't know. It's just very strange. Do you have any thoughts on that, William?
On that line?
That line, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
I didn't think of it too closely. Yeah. Now that you reread it, it seems odd.
The dream sequence that opens the movie, we get a flashback where Mitchell tells us the story of rushing his daughter to the hospital after a black widow bite. Which seems a bit of a stretch to me.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I wanted to be moved by this story of how in a moment he was going to have to make a decision to, you know, give his daughter an emergency tracheotomy.
Mm-hmm.
But he would because he wants her to live so much. Mm-hmm. And that paternal, overwhelming love for a vulnerable 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
But it still didn't play out in a way that I was moved by it.
Mm-hmm.
One, well, it's weird that a 3-year-old is breastfeeding, because he mentions that. Two, we don't really have black widows much in Canada.
Yeah.
And again, I wasn't swept along.
Well, I don't want to interrupt your energy, but it does seem like you're nitpicking a bit because of your because you don't like the movie. I think you're nitpicking too many details. Because I don't remember that they said she was 3. She did?
Yeah.
You're nodding. Okay. All right.
I think you're nitpicking the nitpick, right?
A little bit. Because I think we're not getting to like what we want to talk about if we're getting lost in the details, right? But you said like, I don't know how plausible it is that she got bit by black widows, but that's the story that she got bit by black widows.
Baby, it's just there's widows. Three things that take me.
Well, the way that that's delivered, the doctor says it must have been a baby black widow.
They were on vacation in Florida, yeah. So I think that he's retelling this this experience that he's probably played in his mind many times. I think. It doesn't, the details don't have to be 100% authentic or realistic. I think it's his remembrance of what it was to be in that moment. So, even the images that accompany that telling, they're a bit, again, dreamlike. They don't seem like they have the urgency of
that hecticness of the panic, yeah. the urgency. Yeah, you're right.
So his telling of it is very detached, I think, because he's telling it to this woman on the airplane.
Right.
But he's also in the mindset, I think, as he's telling it, what must be going on in his mind is where his daughter is now, where Chloe is now, that she's a junkie and she's estranged from him.
Right.
And I think the unsaid thing in the telling of that story is, was it worth saving her if her life has just ended up here anyway? If right. she's going to rot away as a right. junkie, so right. why did he save her? I think that's kind of the power of what of his performances is. He is also hiding all these feelings. And in fact, his portraying himself as an instrument of anger for the families, that says something about how he wants to react as a parent. He wants to lash out against something, but he can't lash out against the people who have gotten his daughter addicted, right? So he's trying to compensate professionally for how he's failed as a parent.
Mm-hmm. But I also feel like you're saying, Chris, that story is just kind of unsatisfying, and where it ends up is just kind of unresolved in a way, because he didn't end up having to go to the full extent of performing this tracheotomy to save his daughter. But I feel like that exchange is kind of telling the audience that, you know, you shouldn't be satisfied with how this is going and where it's going to end up, because it's not going to be this cathartic, satisfying ending that I was looking for myself when we get to how that ending comes together. Because the woman that he's sitting next to telling the story to, he just kind of trails off at one point, and she's like, well, what happened? and she's like, what, like, you didn't, what did you have to save her? And he's, and so it's only then that he's like, well, no, like, we got to the hospital in time. And it's funny because it reminds me of this story that my dad tells all the time, that he might have had to make this sacrifice in his professional life in order to make sure that he could get to an event that I was, I don't know, like, singing for something in grade school or whatever, and that he was going to have to, like, go to the chairman of the organization that he worked for and say, oh, excuse me, sir, like, I need to leave this meeting early because my son is performing or whatever. But then, like, the meeting just ended up ending on time, so he didn't have to make that sacrifice. But the way that he tells the story is leads you to hoping that, like, oh, this is satisfying. He's going to...
And I raced through town and fought traffic. Mm-hmm.
Exactly, exactly.
Got into a cab and...
You don't get that satisfaction out of that particular story or the movie as a whole, I don't think.
I've been shitting on this movie, but there's one little exchange that I really liked with Ian Holm and his daughter's friend while they're on the plane, where she says, oh, don't you recognize me? I'm Allison, Allie, your daughter's friend. Her dad, they worked in the same practice. And I think his life has become so compartmentalized that he wouldn't even recognize her or the fact that he worked with her dad. Like, this is someone who's not like, oh, we were in the army together.
Yeah.
This is someone you were in a practice with.
Yeah.
This is someone you have a pretty deep relationship with your business partners and your lawyers together.
Yeah, no, she says
he's compartmentalized things so closely that he doesn't even recognize her or the fact, well, do you remember you worked with my dad? So I thought that was an effective way to say his world is just shrinking to a point, a small little area of control, and everything beyond that he just doesn't want to deal with. So I liked that. I thought, he is just so clenched that he just doesn't allow anything else in.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that moment where he refers to her by the wrong name after, and she's correct him again.
Yeah.
Because I think he's not observing any of that. I think he just has to see one foot in front of him, and that's it. He just can't take in anything else.
Mm-hmm. So there's a fair amount of voiceover from Sarah Polley throughout the movie, as well as her rendition of the Tragically Hip's Courage. Some of that voiceover is related to the action in the movie, but a lot of it is also her just reading lines from The Pied Piper, because that's like the book that she's reading these kids to sleep when she's babysitting, which seems horrifying that you would that you would try and get children to fall asleep to the Pied Piper. But
it has rhymes, at least.
Yeah. The rhymes that lull you into terrifying nightmares, I suppose. But such is German folklore, I suppose. So I went back. I actually read the entirety of the Pied Piper this morning, and you get a sense of it in when you're watching the movie. But that those voiceovers do just kind of glide past you in a way. But reading it on paper, you really get the sense that like these are very similar stories, mm-hmm. Like to the point of it almost being like an adaptation of, in a way. Mm-hmm.
Now, Alexander, I'm not entirely certain because I haven't read Russell Banks's novel.
Right.
But I think the Pied Piper analogy, I think that's Adam McGoin's addition to the story.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
I don't know. But
From what I read, I think that is true, that he married the novel with the Pied Piper of Hamelin.
Yeah, yeah. Which is kind of an ingenious little
agreed.
Adaptation.
Agreed.
Did you want to continue on?
Yeah. So in some of the reviews I was reading of the movie, I get the sense that some people feel like that's a bit sort of heavy-handed and just kind of like being too direct in terms of like trying to get the message across or the point across of what this movie's about. And that it's kind of layering on too many things. But for me, I really enjoy when movies kind of reference other things, and it's like kind of sampling in hip hop or whatever. Like you get a richer experience when one piece of art interacts with another piece of art and they kind of create something new. And there was one line in particular. I wanted to actually try and figure out what line it was exactly, but when Sarah Polley is following her father to the barn when they have this sort of unfortunate exchange, I guess you would say, when the father molests her or does more, we don't really know. But whatever she says in that moment was just like so perfect for what was happening in the scene, and it, like, so it was something to do with the parents not caring about the kids or something. Like I can't remember exactly what the line was. I really want to go back and listen to that. But the layering of you know, like this being a folktale and kind of having its own place in the culture and it being told to kids, et cetera, and relating to the plague and all of these things, that I feel like it's used very effectively in this movie. And so I'm just curious what you guys think.
The character that is left behind, the lame child who isn't able to join the rest of the children as the Pied Piper takes them away, that becomes a Sarah Polley character who ends up being paralyzed and in a wheelchair. But the tragedy is that the person who is left behind isn't, quote, a survivor. That person is just left behind and then never gets to play with those children and never gets to feel that joyful youthfulness.
Yeah.
Now that person is just alone. And that is very much what Sarah Polley's character is. The lame one got left behind, even though she has a sister and a mom and dad. She is completely and entirely in solitude.
Yeah.
Just like the lame character in The Pied Piper.
Yeah. But I also feel like she represents the Pied Piper as well, in a weird way, because she is, at least from what we see, she's the only one who survives this accident. And she represents a variety of the elements of the story, I think, because in a way you could say that the horrific actions that her father takes toward her are like that the bus accident is some form of punishment for that, and the fact that she survives but is now paralyzed as a result is just kind of furthering that punishment. But then she also at the end of the movie becomes the method of punishment against the parents, because she sort of collapses this lawsuit. And it's kind of in that way, it's sort of the inverse of the Pied Piper, because instead of the parents giving money to this individual to save their town from a plague of rats, they're not getting the money from the loss of their children. So yeah, there's just a lot of layers to that inclusion of that folk tale.
The scene in the barn is it's almost, I find it foolishly stagey. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone knows pillar candles and dry hay don't go together. Like, I'm not a farmer, but I understand those two things don't go together. Mm-hmm. And so it ends up being staged like a music video, with the guitar vertically leaning against a hay bale, a whole bunch of pillar candles. Like, it feels like a Shania Twain video is about to be shot. Mm. And I mean, is that him, quote, seducing her because he's seducing the rock star? Like, it just felt so artificially staged. I just wasn't sure what the mood was supposed to be.
Yeah, I wasn't really focusing on the haystacks or the candles or anything, but I think for me the strongest image in that thing and I guess the movie as a whole is the guitar, because she's shown to be, you know, budding musician, and she's got a band behind her, and they're performing at the fair, and that seems to be a source of happiness in her relationship with her father, because they're having this exchange. But it also becomes this very destructive thing, because he's carrying that guitar. I guess that's actually, I hadn't put this together before, but they're driving back from the fair, I presume, and so he's carrying the guitar just because...
Is it the carrot that leads her to the barn?
Yeah, something like that, I guess.
I think it has to do with this whole, I think the father has this sort of fetishization of, and the guitar represents it, that he's constructed this image of his daughter as some sort of, some pop star.
Yeah.
Thing. I think that's what he's infatuated with.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I gathered from it.
Yeah.
And I think that, the staging of the scene in the barn, I think it is a bit mysterious. Like,
yeah.
It's uncomfortable in that it looks like it should be a romantic scene, but
right.
It's a scene of abuse.
Yeah.
So it's complex. It's very odd.
But then the guitar reappears after she gets out of the hospital, and they've kind of redesigned her room, and it's supposed to be this exciting thing. But then the first thing that you see when you walk in is the guitar sitting on the left or on the right. And so, you know, it's like, oh, aren't you happy that you have this new bedroom? It's like, well, maybe not really. And then, you know, she gets the computer because the lawyer, is giving her the computer, and the mother says, oh, well, you know, you can use it to compose your songs. And it immediately cuts to Sarah Polley's face when the mother says this, and she just is dead inside. Like, she's lost that passion because of what's been done to her. And so I feel like that is a really resonant image, because it shows how the abuse that she suffered has taken this thing that was kind of close to her, and that she could potentially turn into a career and so on and so forth, and it's gone now.
But what if that was a construct by her parents? Like, what if that was, they were molding her to be this star?
Yeah, that could be the case. But when she is coming out of the performance at the fair, or I guess they're just doing a sound check, but I did get the sense that...
That she enjoyed it?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, she certainly enjoyed... It seemed like she enjoyed getting the attention from her father.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And I think she would kick back in the way that she kicked back by sort of sabotaging the civil suit. I don't think she'll ever pick up that guitar again.
No.
Because it's the thing that her dad would want her to do. And now, as she said, you don't want me anymore. Mm-hmm. I'm never going to be a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
She'll never play another note,
mm-hmm.
if only to kick back at the thing that will hurt her dad the most.
Mm-hmm.
I want to go back to when you were talking about the Pied Piper Hamelin.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my... My problem, and I don't mean it's a problem, but I guess the thing, my hang-up about that analogy is that I'm trying to find where Adam McGuinn is justifying that analogy by saying this: the town needs to be punished, right? The Pied Piper punishes the town because they won't pay him for the service of ridding them of the rats. So he steals their children. So if the bus accident is the town's children being stolen, I mean, it seems to be an act of God. So is it Adam McGuinn's take that the town needs to be punished for some reason? Is it just because the character is abusing his daughter?
Or the extramarital affair?
So there's a lot of things going on in the town. Is it Adam McGuinn's take that it's a town full of sinners and they need to be punished?
I don't know if sin is necessarily the right word, but I do see the bus accident as a form of punishment, specifically for the abuse inflicted on Sarah Polley's character. I don't know that there could be other reasons that aren't alluded to in the movie, but
you're subscribing to this is divine punishment.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are there other clues though in the movie that says that the town deserves divine punishment?
I think in a broader sense, outside of the town, it's also just punishment for the world and just how, like, if you treat your children poorly, bad things are going to happen, whether it's a freak accident or drug addiction.
Look how much effect. The Ottos loved Bear, their child. And look how much Billy loved his kids.
Yeah.
So I agree with William. I'm unsure of how they would deserve this apocalyptic punishment.
So they don't necessarily,
the children that are well loved.
Yeah. So I don't think that they necessarily deserve it, but I think
Collateral damage?
Yeah, it's collateral damage, and it's an idea that, like, the abuse that's inflicted on Sarah Polley is substantial enough that, you know, when the universe sort of fights back, like, this is what's going to happen.
It's going to be that big.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, you can't control how vast the you know, the impact of that evil is.
Okay, can we talk about Nicole and her testimony?
Yes.
All right.
Leading into that, though, I think it's interesting to relate it to the interaction that they have with the lawyer in preparation for her deposition.
Okay.
Okay.
Just because in that exchange, she explicitly says, "I will not lie. I will tell the truth no matter what." Mm-hmm. And stares at her and her father have an exchange in that moment, and you get the sense like this is where I thought the movie was leading, was that, however the line of questioning went, she was going to have an opportunity to reveal the abuse inflicted on her, and that might be some hopeful thing that would come out of this movie. That, you know, her father would be punished in that way, and it unfortunately does not go that way, but he still gets punished, I guess.
Well, he gets punished because his fantasy is shattered.
Yeah, but also they're financially struggling because they can't pay for her medical bills. So anyway, I think it's interesting to point out that she says, "I will not lie," but then when she gets to the deposition, the unfolding of this entire case is due to the fact that she does lie.
Mm-hmm. Did you know right away that she lied, or did you have to wait till the father and Mitchell were having their conversation when they said she lied?
Yeah, I knew. You know immediately.
I knew immediately
because Bruce Greenwood was saying, like, I was driving behind them and I know that she wasn't speeding. Okay. I feel like the way that he's dealing with his grief, mm-hmm. he would want to blame Dolores if she was driving too fast.
Well, that's okay. a good point. Yeah.
And so the fact that he says no, she was driving the speed limit. Okay. I find it weird that they're in Canada, but they're using miles per hour as well.
Yeah, actually.
Miles per hour. And his daughter says she quotes was selling her blood, and that's how she found out she was HIV positive. In yeah. Canada, it's against the law to sell your blood, but in the U.S., you can.
Right.
So
she might have gone to the U.S. As a you, now my turn to nitpick.
then let's nitpick a little bit.
Okay, but in the testimony, so in, when Nicole, okay, actually, let me back up a moment. This whole thing about lying, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because the setup for her testimony, there's like another lawyer, not the Ian Holm character. So he's asking, the other lawyer is asking the questions. Mm-hmm. And at one point, So Nicole first, she's like, oh, my memory is kind of foggy. But then she starts to say, oh, wait, this is getting pretty clear now, right? Mm-hmm. And the one lawyer says, what was the weather like? And she said it was snowing. And that's when Ian Holm, he has an objection. He's like, well, if you're going to submit the weather as evidence, we have to be official with this, right?
Yeah.
Okay. When we saw the scene, it wasn't snowing.
No, it wasn't.
So this is the first indication that there's something that's not right, right?
Yeah.
But it also would hint that if they got all the evidence together, they would see that things don't match up.
Right.
So it also seems like it leaves it open that her testimony could be...
Picked apart.
Yeah, could be
disqualified. And I mean, you could even like go back to the bus and sit where she was sitting and say, well, oh no, you can't really see the speedometer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely got the sense that it wasn't this, like you pulled one of the legs out and the whole thing crumbles kind of thing. It didn't seem like that to me.
It just, there's holes in her story.
Yeah.
Seemed, mm-hmm. right? And then when she says, I saw that the speedometer was 72 miles per hour. I mean, that's very precise. There's not a line that says 72.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of a weird.
If you said 70, we'd yeah. be like, well, that seems likely.
Yeah. And so this is my nitpick is because they say miles per hour. I mean, if they're going 50 miles per hour on a snowy road, that's hell of a lot of speed.
That's 80 kilometers an hour.
Yeah.
Right?
That's really
Holy
fast on a snowy
shit.
Road.
Yeah.
And then if they were, and if, her testimony was they're going 70. That's 120, 110, 120 kilometers per hour.
Which on a hairpin turn
yeah.
on
yeah.
a snowy
which
mountain.
Which is just ridiculous.
Preposterous. Yeah.
yeah. So that's why I was waiting.
And a bus can't even really get yeah. up to those things on a winding
even going
highway.
Downhill, I don't think
yeah.
they yeah. can.
Which is why I was waiting for the other foot to drop, was for someone, for the Ian Holm character to say, like, wait, there's things that don't add up in this story.
Yeah.
But that never happens.
Well, do you think that the fact that she's a 13-year-old girl who's been sort of cut down in the prime of her life and now she's in a wheelchair for life, are you going to grill that young woman? Are you going to make her feel small? Are you yeah. going to accuse her of being a liar? Her vulnerability by being in that chair and surviving will
you
not
would.
Allow you,
oh, you
to challenge it.
You would if you had hundreds
millions
of millions
of
dollars on the line.
All yeah. right. Okay.
But I guess to a certain extent, we don't really get too much insight into what Ian Holm's case is mm-hmm. and what evidence he's bringing forward and those kinds of things. And so it could be that they really, everything was riding on her testimony. Mm-hmm. And so, even if you can poke holes in it, if she doesn't provide a testimony that says, yeah, no, there were no issues. Dolores was a great driver, all that. It must have been some sort of mechanical problem. If you don't get that out of her, then what is your case kind of thing? Cause there's no, he does the short video shot inside the bus, but it doesn't seem like, or at least the movie doesn't present us with any evidence that there was actually this mechanical problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It just seems like Ian Holm's character didn't really fight enough.
Yeah.
For some reason. Toward the conclusion of Nicole's testimony. When all those gathered they're surprised by what she said. Mm-hmm. It goes to voiceover and Nicole, it sounds like she's reading from the Pied Piper again, but these are actually lines that were not in the poem, in the Pied Piper.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. So these are added by Adam McGuinn.
Okay.
Yeah. So she says,
I like how you've properly indented your poetry there.
Well, yeah, so
put a footnote and a citation there.
I have to quote. I have to know where I'm quoting. Yeah. And why I lied, he only knew. But from my lie, this did come true. Those lips from which he drew his tune were frozen as a winter moon. So, and in that moment, they cut to a close up of her father, who's just frozen because he's realized like he's lost his chance to make money off of this.
Mm-hmm.
But the weird thing about those lines is it sounds like it's Sarah Polley narrating a story to the audience suddenly, because this doesn't have anything to do with the Pied Piper story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some of her other voiceover is kind of like commenting on the story, and mm-hmm. I did pick up on that at a few points.
So she's also become a narrator like on a level above the events of the movie.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Because the quote that you were talking about earlier was, all of us, Dolores, me, the children who survived, so I guess there were more survivors, the children who didn't live, we're all living in a different town, we're living in the sweet hereafter. So,
yeah.
Again, that's obviously not part of the Pied Piper, so she is talking to us as well. In that.
Maybe those are lines from the book, and she's the narrator in the book.
Possibly, yeah. I hadn't read the book. My understanding of the book was that like, it's told from different points of view because there's like testimony about the accident.
Right.
Yeah.
And she wouldn't know about affairs and all of that. So it's got to be
That's true.
A sort of a Rashomon type of narrative.
Yeah.
So here I'm kind of on board with Chris, where I wish there was more in Sarah Polley's performance so that I could know what's going on in her mind.
Right.
So on first viewing, I didn't know that she was lying. I didn't know if she was, she was just experiencing a flood of memories that were clarifying things, or if she was deliberately lying because she wanted to put one over on the parents, on the adults.
I think a lot of that comes through, at least for me, I knew she was lying immediately, but then, it was reinforced by the glances that are exchanged between her and her father.
Mm.
And it was more the reaction of the father on his face. Like he realizes this is falling apart. That's how I kind of figured that out.
Okay.
I guess.
All right. It's still weird though, that if everyone sitting in the room knows that she's lying, why wouldn't they press the point?
And he's
like, well, yeah, let's get the straight story. So, mm-hmm. yeah. But that's how it goes for you.
Mm-hmm.
Can I make one observation?
Yes, as long as it's not a nitpick.
I can't quite loop all these things together, but I'd be curious to know who was in charge of sort of Telefilm Canada through the 90s. Because Paul and I were talking about this movie and where it placed when we were watching a lot of Canadian movies in the mm-hmm. 90s. And when you start... So I started making sort of a short list of the movies that I saw released theatrically in the 90s, none of which move me because they all have that flat... they're all so doer.
Mm.
And I don't know why... We had to make movies like that. I think we still kind of make movies like that. Mm-hmm. Super earnest, super doer. So when I started listing them, like Exotica, Live Bait, Night is Falling, Margaret's Museum, Crash, Kissed, Hanging Garden, Cube, Dirty, Last Night, Red Violin, Existence, New Waterford Girl. No laughs. No laughs in these movies.
I think Existence is pretty funny.
Oh, I do not like that movie. So there's Hardcore Logo. Which is entertaining.
Yeah.
But everything else is just so fucking serious.
Yeah.
Why? This was our flavor. Do you think we still have that flavor?
You're missing Naked Lunch in there.
You're right, I am.
That movie is ridiculous and over the top and hilarious.
Yeah. It's a knee slapper. Benway.
You guys remember that one? Roy Scheider... like rips his skin off or he's like a woman and he like rips the woman's skin off and it's Roy Scheider and he's like Benway and then like rips his own skin off again and turns back into the woman.
Oh god. Nope, don't remember that.
It's ridiculous.
Do you think we still have that same narrative flavor?
I think there's I'm just like from what I observe when I look at the like the film fest programs and stuff like that. I think Telefilm is trying to be a bit more populist. I think they're trying to appeal to, I think they're trying to have things that are a bit more fun and for a younger crowd.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I guess
that's encouraging. I want to see that in Canadian movies, but yeah. Honestly, that decade was just grim. I mean, it was popular. They were actually getting theatrical releases, and they were getting nominated for Oscars in a few cases.
But I think that's might be what happened was that a couple of these directors made their type of movie, mm-hmm. and it got global recognition.
Right.
Right. Got accolades at Cannes and other places. It makes top 10 lists
so
all over the world.
So this is the thing we want to replicate.
That's right.
We
they say this is our
mood,
product.
This tone, this subject.
Give us more of this, because we're getting on the map.
Okay.
The 90s was when Canadian movies were on the international map.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, Laiolo would be in that vein as well. Yeah.
And I didn't include any French things, because they're always more vibrant and interesting than the English-Canadian content that came out in that decade.
Right.
They're just a lot more lively.
Side note, Chris said Dewar instead of Dower, which is actually Chris said it the right way.
Oh, interesting.
Isn't there an American and a Canadian pronunciation?
So is it sewer instead of sour?
No, the root is French.
So we have the task of comparing this to another movie.
Yeah. So do we look at something that has a similar narrative structure or tone? Or what do you think?
I don't... I guess we were talking about this a bit before recording, and I guess we didn't really come to much of a consensus. I would personally want to compare it to Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me, but I know you guys said that you both haven't seen that in a long time.
Yeah, I just wouldn't have enough of a memory to make that comparison. Yeah.
And I mentioned Manchester by the Sea, but we all haven't seen it, because it's about the loss of children.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. No, I'm not sure if I'll see it.
Oh, really? You're kidding, right?
No, I'm not kidding.
Okay, never mind. Nothing.
Okay.
I don't think that's much of a spoiler, though.
No.
Although it in its nonlinear editing, you don't really know that that's coming until about a quarter or halfway.
That's true.
Yeah.
Oh, and Roger Ebert, who I know we all miss and admired, his quote about the movie was, "One of the best films of the year, an unflinching lament for the human condition." I wish it was that.
Well, I mean, it was Roger Ebert said it. So. Yeah,
all right.
Not Chris's condition.
I Ebert, therefore I am.
Yeah.
Titanic. You also mentioned Titanic.
Well, just because they were in the same year, and both directors were nominated at the Oscars, and reportedly James Cameron told Ed McGowan that they made the same movie.
Right.
Yeah. That is mechanical passenger vehicles that sank into freezing waters.
Right.
Shall we compare it to Titanic?
That's one that I only saw when I was a kid when it came out.
You don't feel like you have enough of a memory?
No.
Okay. What about Fargo? You said Fargo initially.
Yeah.
All right.
I think in terms of the setting,
it's beautifully shot.
The score, I would say that Fargo looks better than this movie.
Yeah, but I think with a $5 million budget,
yeah,
I thought that.
Well, I don't know that the Coen brothers would have had much more than that to make Fargo.
I think they both look very cold.
Yeah.
Yes, so. And remote and isolated.
Although to be fair, I wasn't watching an HD quality version of the movie.
I was watching a really terrible DVD copy from the library.
Yeah. Whereas the Blu-ray I have of Fargo is pretty top notch. Yeah, I mean in terms of the sort of non-human nature of the characters, I think it is similar in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think Egoyan's direction of Gabriel Rose made her seem like a Margie.
Yeah.
She just had such a strong Canadian accent. You know, get on the bus, Bear. Yeah, get to sit on the front of the bus, Bear. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Though I think she said A, not Yeah.
She said A. Yeah, she did. Yeah. Yeah.
As a Canadian would.
So maybe Fargo is the right movie to compare this to.
All right. Well, so our unique rating system, using our unique rating system, we will set Fargo at the 0 point, and we'll each then score the suite you're after accordingly in comparison with Fargo, from plus 10 if we love it, to minus 10 if we absolutely hate it.
I'm going to say Fargo minus 2 or 3, just because Fargo is really good, maybe even one of the best movies there is. And The Suite Hereafter is also really good, but maybe not one of the best movies that there is.
Okay. You want to go next?
Fargo minus 9.
Wow. Okay. I would put The Suite Hereafter as Fargo minus 4.
Cool.
Okay. One interesting tidbit. The role of Ian Holm was initially occupied by Donald Sutherland. So that would have been a different movie.
Canadian, eh?
Yeah, eh? Yeah, get on the bus, Don. We're going to the show.
So if Donald Sutherland was in that role, then you think it would have been Kiefer Sutherland as a strung out child?
Daddy!
One more daddy, then it's in the can. Yeah.
Did you guys know that Zoe is played by Russell Banks' daughter?
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that's interesting.
This is, I think, episode 76. We're going to keep going to episode number 100 on this current schedule. We're trying to do 2 a month. And then after episode 100, we'll have fulfilled our contract and I can collect my magic bullets. What are you getting out of this, Alexander?
Garlic? Is this like a werewolf thing or...?
Well, no, if you make a deal with the devil, you get something, right?
Or no, garlic is for vampire.
Yeah. Are you getting magic beans or are you getting 3 wishes?
Magic jumping beans sound good, yeah. Mexican jumping beans.
I'm getting the golden goose. So. Nice.
Okay. So we're almost there.
And a beer.
So after episode 100, we will probably take a break. Maybe we'll continue this this effort in a different form. But until then, we'll keep at it. So with only that many episodes left, some roughly 25, if every listener were to suggest one more movie for us to do, we would then need you to suggest a second one.
Oh, I thought you were going to say... If every listener suggested a movie, we would then run out of Canadian movies to talk about.
Yeah, well, it is definitely not a comedy podcast, so you can get those elsewhere. Thanks, guys.
Goodbye.
Thanks, guys.